This edition of Culture with Robert Bound was first broadcast on the 22nd of December 2014 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to the 165th edition of Culture with me, Robert Bounds. This week we're pulling on our winter woolies, making sure the cashmere scarf is snug around the neck and, oh no, that's for some other losers. This week we're all about the sunniest, funnest art fair in the West. Art Basel Miami Beach has just removed its Ray-Bans after a week of artistic hijinks in the Florida sun, and we'll meet the movers and shakers who made this year extra special. Coming to you live from the honeymoon suite at the Edition Hotel South Beach, this is Culture with me, Robert Bounds. And the director of Art Basel, Mark Spiegler, will be reflecting on the week that was, with a well-deserved sundowner in hand, of course.
It has nothing to do with direct revenue for us, but it has to do with our belief in what we want the art world to be, which is a place which is centered around galleries and artists and not just around objects that are getting commodified.
That tenacious Henry Hoover of Art Market Secrets, Charlotte Burns of the Art Newspaper, will give her two pennies worth.
Miami isn't the place to come if you really want to have serious, engaged conversations. Not that they aren't happening, but it's not the main point of this place as a city, and it's not really the fair for that either.
And that most charming and disarming of gallerists, Alexander Gray, will tell us why art fair discourse will always be about social issues versus lots of dollars.
It's pretty core to our mission and to the vision of the gallery, which is really to make exhibitions and to raise awareness about artists who've been overlooked in the market because of race, because of gender, because of geography, this kind of trifecta that we're interested in.
Plus, we'll meet Stephen Friedman, a man with a big green boulder in his gallery, Hans Meyer, a German with a passion for the palms of Miami Beach, High Five the effervescent Alexander Gilks of Paddle 8 Online Auctioneers, and Rock Out with Art Rockers TV on the radio, and tour the best of the rest of what Miami had to offer. That's all to come here on Culture with me, Robert Bounds, on Monocle 24. Our rum is straight up, our beer has a lime in the lip of the bottle. Down on Miami Beach, all remains much the same. The sun is shining, bronzed bodies litter the sand, and bedheaded swimmers are seeking morning solace. The speedos are tight, the bikinis are small. But what's this? That's the sound of an intimidatingly large sculpture made from recycled plastic bottles and tubing, roaming free on Miami's shore, and it's one of a few. They're kinetic sculptures made by artist Theo Jansen, called Strand Beasts, and have been let loose for Art Basel. The fair isn't confined to the four walls of the Miami Beach Convention Centre. It sprawls across the city, even over onto the mainland, with galleries, satellite fairs and sculpture parks taking part in the festivities, meaning you might stumble across things like this on your morning jog.
We are by no means thinking only of the world war that draws near. It is a meaning of the conscious.
Since 2002, the main fair has grown to feature 250 galleries and attracts over 75,000 visitors a year. There's a film programme, over 20 of those satellite fairs, various music events, and that's all before you've even got to the front door. This year there was even some Miami Vice, and I'm not talking the after parties. There was an actual art heist featuring a Picasso going walkabout. What we're getting at is that there's a lot to keep a very beady eye on. So who better to explain how you keep the mayhem minimal and the cash flowing than the director of Art Basel himself, Mark Spiegler. Here he is with Monocle's Nelly Gotcheva.
This has been an exceptionally smooth fair for us. You always have hopes and fears. This was a year where few of our fears came true, and when they did, we were able to fix things quickly. But especially a lot of our hopes came true. We introduced a new sector this year called Survey, which is focused on art historical projects, and we had hoped that this would be really a window into the work of artists who had been, in a sense, overlooked or forgotten, you know, in the course of the art market's progression. And it really was that. It was precisely what we'd hoped for. We had outsider artists like Henry Darger, who a lot of people don't know, but also, for instance, there was a group of work from Galerie Valois in Paris by Nicky de Saint-Phalle, which was the early abstract work which very few people knew. Likewise, there was an artist named Lottie Rosenfeld at Espavizor Gallery from Valencia in Spain, again, not a very well-known artist, but the work was selling to museums like MoMA. So this was really a sector which became very rapidly a favorite of the most connoisseur collectors, of the curators, the museum directors. And it's precisely the kind of thing that we want. It's good to have this as a counterbalance to the blue chip work and to the super young work that we have in the fair.
And I was actually just about to ask you about the international trends. So you just mentioned Spain, and of course here in Florida, South American galleries seemed very strong this year again. So any other international trends that you've noticed?
I mean, one thing I would say is this is a fair for the Americas. And yet, because of the development of the art market in Latin American galleries still only represent about 10 or 15% of the fair. Although, of course, there's some more Latin American artists that are present in other galleries. You know, what do we see here? I think what we see is the further internationalization of the art world, in the sense that we see more and more galleries who are coming up from Latin America, but also we see galleries coming for the first time from Asia here. And I think that's a result of the fact that there are more and more galleries in Asia who are familiar with Art Basel as an organization and with whom Art Basel's committees are familiar, who are coming in and who make this incredible trip across 12 time zones, literally halfway around the world, to come and show here, often to great success. I mean, for instance, Tetsuya Yoshida, who showed with Y++ WADA Arts, you know, already on the first day was selling works for more than $350,000 to institutions. This was an artist who, you know, who died at a very young age, was more or less overlooked outside of his country, and has had a real revival at the highest level of connoisseurship.
We didn't get lost so much this year. How do you tinker with the layout to make it feel human-sized?
Every art fair is a temporary urbanism, and we think a lot about that. We learn from experience, obviously. In 2009, we had a rather disastrous floor plan, and we took several nights off the circuit, so to speak, during the fair and walked through the halls trying to figure it out. But, you know, this is a floor plan that we've been working on for the last 6 years, and I think we've really figured out how to work it. And, you know, in a sense, the floor plan here is like Manhattan. You have a large area in the middle, which is where you rest and relax, like Central Park, and then you have streets and avenues running north, south, and east, west. But I think a lot of it is basically about understanding how much people can digest before they need to sit down, before they need to eat. And then also structuring the fair. The way the fair is structured is that in every corner of the hall, you have a different sector or entryway. And I think that allows people to mentally map it in their minds.
We are in Miami, and yeah, it's known as a more like a party town. So what is the rhythm of the fair and the openings and the parties? How many things do you attend in the day and in the evening?
During the day, I'm in the halls, which is where I should be, because that's where the galleries are, and that's where the collectors are. You know, in the morning, I'm often visiting the private collections to see what's there and to see who's there. And in the evening, I go around and see and attend the events of various galleries and various sponsors. And then starting around midnight, I see my friends who are in town.
So which were you excited about in terms of new galleries? You kind of mentioned new artists and new galleries being present already. But what about new sections in attendance?
So the survey sector came about because we realized that there were galleries coming with interesting art historical projects who were too established to be in Nova or Positions, but we weren't sure were ready to be in the main sector of galleries on an annual basis. And also because we felt like there was more and more interest in the historical within the greater art world. So we created a sector, and this is based on a long experience with the feature sector in Basel, which was specifically for art historical projects. The reaction has been tremendous. Other gallerists love it. Curators love it. Critics love it. The collectors who really know a lot about our history love it, because even as much as one can know, there's always more to discover. And for them, they know that discovery lies as much in looking through the archives as looking through the internet and trying to figure out what's going on right now.
And you just mentioned the internet, so that was my next question.
Sure.
Where do you stand in terms of digital and also interactive submersive art? There was New York Times Luxury Conference just before Art Basel kicked off. A lot of the topics discussed over there was about art, but also digital technology. So where do you stand?
Personally speaking, I'm a technophile. Since I started in 2007, we believe strongly that the internet is a great builder of momentum for the fairs and also a great way to have a long tail after the fairs. But we don't believe that art is something which can be virtualized. So the virtual to digital is very important for us in terms of building the echo chamber around what is done at the shows and around what the galleries do. But we're never going to do a virtual fair, for example.
What is next for Brand Basel, generally speaking? What can we guys expect from you?
In a sense, what we're entering now is the third stage of Art Basel as an entity within the art world. In the first stage, from 1970 to roughly the late 90s, Art Basel was primarily a market platform. It was a place where people who had something to sell came to meet people who wanted to buy something. It was much more about the objects and the halls. And then starting in the late 90s, but especially with the launch of Art Basel in Miami Beach, the thinking about Basel expanded to think of it more as to the point where it was more about the whole week. So the halls were important, but it was also important to have a full week of events because we realized that people are coming not just to see what's in the halls, but also to have the whole experience. So there was a lot of attention to working with partners, private collections for doing events outside of the art world per se. And now, in a sense, partly because of the way the art world has evolved, but also partly because of the way Art Basel has evolved by taking on a whole other hemisphere, by moving to Asia in 2013, we really feel like we have a global position with the art world. And I think a very good example of that is our partnership with Kickstarter. This started in early September. It's specifically targeted to do crowdfunding for nonprofit organizations in the visual arts. Since we started, which is to say 2 months ago, or 3 months ago, since it started 3 months ago, we've raised about $185,000 for 8 different visual arts organizations. Every organization whose project has come to a deadline has been fully funded. So we're very happy about that. And it's been a really interesting experience because it connects this huge crowd of people, the 300,000 Facebook followers, the 150,000 Twitter followers, with the nonprofits, who I think as a group are an organization who are often under-evaluated and certainly have the most difficulty in terms of fundraising because they're specifically non-commercial projects. And yet, for us, when we look at the broader ecosystem of the art world, they're incredibly important because the nonprofits tend to be the places that function as a sort of lab or testing ground for a lot of artists. So when we do funding for an organization like Delfina or Gasworks in London to do residencies, for example, for artists from the Middle East, then it really has a contribution to the art world. It has nothing to do with direct revenue for us, but it has to do with our belief in what we want the art world to be, which is a place which is centered around galleries and artists and not just around objects that are getting commodified.
That was Mark Spiegler, director of Art Basel Miami Beach, speaking to Nelly Godcheva, kicking off our entire show from the fair. It is a tough life. So let's get cracking onto some of the galleries themselves. Alexander Gray Associates is one with a shortish history, but a firm reputation for good taste, learning worn lightly, and a main man in Alexander Gray himself, with a good wardrobe and an eager chuckle. I do him a disservice. Alexander Gray is the nicest art dealer in the world, who at Art Basel was showing works from two American artists of the 1990s, Jack Whitten and Melvin Edwards. Enough of my yakking, here's A. Gray himself.
We always try to bring a very focused presentation for the public and our curatorial colleagues to really engage with. So the kind of visible part of our booth has a exhibition focused on work by two artists, Jack Whitten and Melvin Edwards, their works from the 90s. But we're standing enjoying our convention center tanning devices. The lovely lighting here is our back room, kind of our VIP lounge deep within our booth, where we've brought specific works for specific clients, but also smaller works by the artists that we're exhibiting, but also other artists in the gallery's program so we can represent the scope of our vision.
Out in the main space of your stand here, Alexander, you've got a couple of artists. You always have a curatorial way of putting these booths together, which stands out, as always has stood out at the art fairs. Is that something that's getting easier as your presence sort of deepens into people's consciousness in the art fair, or is that just something you'd never change?
It's pretty core to our mission and to the vision of the gallery, which is really to make exhibitions and to raise awareness about artists who've been overlooked in the market because of race, because of gender, because of geography, this kind of trifecta that we're interested in. With the presentation that we've made this year, we have two artists who are enjoying a lot of museum visibility, Jack Whitten, who's retrospective at the Museum of Contemporary Art in San Diego, is up now and is traveling throughout the U.S., and Melvin Edwards, who has a retrospective opening in Dallas at the Nasher Sculpture Center in January. But we wanted to focus that even further on their work from the 90s. These are two African-American artists who have been practicing since the 60s, and the 90s, which was a decade very polemic around identity politics, and not a decade that we really think about relating to abstraction and to process-based work, but more towards narrative about identity and Black identity when we're, drilling that even further. So an opportunity for us to shift the narrative and shift the retrospective narrative on how we think about that recent moment in art history.
What you've just been talking about will be a nice surprise to many of our listeners, I think, who sometimes can see the large art fairs as being, supermarkets in a way, that you have such a sort of strong curatorial sensibility, and that we're talking about black identity in the 1990s, at very much what is a selling show. It must be nice to have the opportunity to put on something that brings in all these other themes, right?
Yeah, I think, you know, the art fairs, and certainly, you know, Miami gets this identity as being, you know, very salesy, very shiny, very sparkly, and people here to make quick transactions that are speculative and high return on low, you know, all this market drama. But what really happens here is it is a convening mechanism for museum directors, for their trustees, for curators, the core constituency of the art world. And this fair is of that quality. And so all of us who exhibit, this is what we're ultimately what we're here to do. I mean, we need to support our artists through selling their work. We need to support our gallery programs by selling work. But the goal is, of course, engagement with museums, because the art outlasts all of us and outlasts hopefully our bank accounts as well. And this is what we leave behind. So it's not just about sales in an environment about like this.
That was Alexander Gray speaking to me for this Art Basel Miami Beach edition of Culture on Monocle 24.
Istanbul is fast emerging as a serious player on the international design stage. Monocle Films headed to the Bosphorus to cover this year's Design Biennial.
The projects are experimental, they're visionary, they're about questioning, they're about proposing and identifying ways forward and new directions, as much as they are about realizing outcomes.
Creating a Contemporary Design Manifesto, the Istanbul Design Biennial, premiering in the film section on Monocle.com.
Welcome back to Culture with me, Robert Bounds, coming this week from the sexy environs of Art Basel Miami Beach. With Alexander Gray just now, we talked about the works of not that well-known artists, but now we're going for some broader brushstrokes and some bigger names. Charlotte Burns of the Art Newspaper was strutting the aisles of the Convention Center in Miami, getting the lowdown on the larger themes. What's selling, who's buying, and how to survive the fair when feet in flats just won't do.
I asked a dealer what they were bringing to Miami, and he said, oh, a really cheerful booth. And I said, is that because you feel particularly cheerful, or is that just because it's Miami? He said, don't put it in print. And I thought it was interesting that people are sort of embarrassed somewhat about saying, you know, there's this Miami art, and it's very cheerful, usually it's very bright, it's, you know, not particularly reflective often, unless it's shiny. And so I was thinking, well, why is that a bad thing? Look at the popularity of the Matisse show in London, which was the most well-attended exhibition the Tates ever had. And I thought, well, maybe it's something to do with our times, that people want joy in this way they didn't need before. Is it tied to that, or is it simply tied to the market and the incredible amounts of cash coming into the art market right now, that, you know, it's slightly easier to buy brighter art? It's more understandable. In times of recession, you tend to see a return to content, and these sort of big sort of steroidal works start to feel a little bit superficial. That's what an art advisor told me, looking at the 80s. The same thing happened. By the beginning of the 80s, things were getting bigger and bigger and bigger in tandem with the money. And then by the end of the 80s, as the AIDS crisis was rolling in, there was a homeless crisis in New York, things started to get a little bit more restrained and reflective. And what's interesting about Miami is that those things are happening in the world, but the art market isn't really in the same place as the news we're seeing, you know, on CNN every day.
I guess there's an interesting disconnect between the art that we can see looking around us in some of the blue chip galleries around here in Miami and the general discourse that we see in the newspapers. The art doesn't match the times, maybe, or maybe it matches the times of the art market, which is a completely different economy, it seems.
Exactly. I mean, the art market is a different beast than the art world at large. You know, you see different things in museums than you see in the art market. And plus, you know, if people are reacting to the times, we won't see that because it's in the studios. So we won't see it this week. You know, the reactions to Eric Garner this week, the lack of indictment there. Although there is a reaction to the Ferguson riots on Friedrich Petzl. They have a Robert Longo drawing of the police. It's this huge charcoal drawing. It's really great. And the artist said, you know, he felt so sort of distressed by the news, he felt he had to do something. So there are things in amongst the works here, you just have to look a little bit harder for them.
It's one of those interesting things. We spoke to Alexander Gray in New York, It was talking about art of the 90s and sort of art about black identity and all the rest of it. This seemed to me to be a strange conversation to be having at Art Basel Miami. But actually, this is about art rather than always about the market, isn't it? And it's about people presumably having conversations about things they like, things they don't like, about being engaged with the wider world than just talking about the zeros on the ends of these big prices, isn't it?
To some extent, you have to think of where we are. We're in Miami, which is, you know, it's a beach town. It's a town full of neon. The beaches are man-made. You know, there's something hedonistic about Miami, and it's not itself as a place totally engaged with the rest of the world, you know, and the darker politics. I mean, obviously underneath. So you have to, I mean, it's the end of the year. People have been working hard. It is a market thing. Miami isn't the place to come if you really want to have serious, engaged conversations. Not that they aren't happening, but it's not the main point of this place as a city. And it's not really the fair for that either. There's a difference between this fair and Switzerland, the Basel there, the Mothership Fair. And that's, you know, often to do with the different art histories as well. You know, pop is an American movement. It began here in the US. It's a different art history. You know, American minimalism is different than European minimalism. They had different taste, and you see that in their markets. So you see that in Miami too, that there are certain works that you would show here that just wouldn't make sense in Europe because their trajectories have been different.
And you mentioned the seamy underworld of Miami. Another nice piece of editorial you've got in the art newspaper is about some of the sexy works on display here. There's Meat and Two Veg, there's Tits Out, it's all kicking off. There's almost as much naked flesh in some of the canvases as there is on general display amongst the art buying clientele here and on Miami Beach. Am I right or am I wrong? Certainly it's a nice thing to put in the art newspaper, right?
Well, it was fun, you know, going around looking, and we were definitely taken by the extent of flesh on show, both inside and outside the fair. And we were asking people about it, and Team Gallery has a nice Ryan McGinley of a couple cavorting in the Dakota grasslands. And I said to him, you know, during the recession, I remember in Freeze a few years ago, we wrote an article saying, you know, no sex please, we're British. And during the recession, it kind of disappeared. Taste became a lot more restrained, a bit more puritanical, and you're seeing the stays have loosened and those things are out. And Jose Freire, the director of Team Gallery, said, well, if all this money coming into the market doesn't at least make people feel like they can really push things in terms of content, then what's the point? So that was a kind of nice takeaway too, that it's definitely more freedom of flesh here, yeah.
And before we finish, we should talk about a couple of ways to survive the art fair. We mentioned that the art newspaper puts out a paper every day of the fair. There's a lot of running around researching and then presumably writing copy here under the roof of the convention centre. What are the tips to survive it? Do you have to have clever footwear? Do you have to have a change of clothes in a locker somewhere in order to be able to go out and do the parties in the evening? What are the secrets of your success to covering the fair?
Well, everyone does recommend sensible footwear, which I ignore because I'm 5'1" and I can't actually talk to people and look them in the eyes if I wear flat shoes. So I ignore that. But most of the art newspaper team do go swimming in the sea every morning. It's a nice way to shake off fatigue or hangovers, whichever one you have, and get back to work. And other than that, we think of ourselves as, you know, human ATM cash machines. The editor says 600 words, we spew it out.
That was the art newspaper's irrepressible Charlotte Burns. The wonderful thing about such an enormous fair like Art Basel Miami Beach is the possibility of discovery as much as getting lost. Hans Meyer has been a big boy on the European art scene for decades, opening his gallery with Joseph Albers in 1965. But the stringent concerns of the European avant-garde love a party and a palm tree too. The Düsseldorf Gallery has brought laid-back Miami style to life in a series of large drawings of palm trees by Robert Longo. I spoke to Hans about how to choose the work you bring to the fair depending on your location.
In each fair I'm participating now since more than 40 years, I always create a special room. I was the first who put this white floor in, or ceilings, or things like this. And it always starts with one major piece, and the major piece is the Soluit sculpture, and you have to create a space around it. And then you got from the artists. One artist calls you and make a nice palm tree. Yeah. Then you think in the storage for different artists who are using palm trees. And this creates an atmosphere.
And there is a sense of, there's a nice conversation being had, yes, between the pieces. You mentioned the Soluit.
Yes.
It's tough to house such a beautiful but such a monumental work in a booth at an art fair. Is that a challenge? Is it a nice challenge to have to meet?
You know, at first it's the art piece which motivates you. And it's not the client or the money or what is behind. You just have the idea and you have to follow the idea. And I had good experience like this. You do something crazy, everybody's realize that's crazy to bring something like this here, but it's very positive always.
And the palm tree works, you mentioned there's a beautiful shape to this that suggests the palm trees, suggests where we are in the world as well, Miami Beach, it's all very cool. The works that come to the art fair here, are they all part of the Hans Meyer stable? How do you source such relevant works to the city in which you find yourself this week?
You know, you see here's a Bill Beckley. Uh-huh. This piece is done in 74 or 75. I have showed it already in this time. Then I was thinking, oh, I will show this one. Then it's a Robert Longo new drawing. He said, for Florida, you will get a beautiful palm tree. And it's really sensational. Then we have outside from Los Angeles, Rübsamen, who also walks with a palm tree, and suddenly everything fits very well together and creates this atmosphere.
Is Miami Beach a favoured place of yours to come for an art fair? I mean, it looks when you walk onto your booth that I'm feeling like I'm walking home here. You know, I feel like I'm walking into the booth of a man that really enjoys the city of Miami. Is this all for show, or do you get to walk on the beach every morning as well?
No, I'm too tired.
That was Hans Meyer, and his gallery is based in Düsseldorf, if you're ever passing and fancy checking out a bit of Miami cool in Europe. Still to come, in part two, we'll investigate a musical installation back on Miami's mainland. We'll visit a few more galleries at the fair, and then we'll head to NADA, the satellite fair, where only the coolest hang art and hang out. That's all to come here on Culture with me, Robert Bound. Now, as you're probably getting the hang of by now, Art Week in Miami attracts the more stellar end of the market. Yes, we swapped anecdotes with Leonardo DiCaprio's art advisor. Yes, we almost fell off a yacht, but you expect this. In the competitive art world, art fairs are where the gallerists fight back against the might of the auction houses. But what happens when your house isn't made of bricks and mortar at all? You might have heard of Padlate, the online auctioneers set up by the toothsome Brit. There are two of us, you know. Alexander Gilks. Where does that feed into the rest of it? Poolside, beshaded, warming up with a rum, he told us.
Where we've really tried to focus Padlate's efforts is on looking at building a 21st century auction house and really trying to understand what are the motivations of today's collector, is essentially ADD riddled, more nomadic than ever before, craves immediacy, is more eclectic than previously. Prior to this, many collectors tend to be very vertical centric, collect purely within certain very tight narratives and themes. And today, due to their travels and their access to information, they're just far more cultured and far more, they have a greater propensity for risk in what they collect. So Padlate has really tried to think about how we can build an auction entity online only that removes all of the costs and the cumbersome selling and buying obstacles from a brick and mortar auction house, and that fits in that white space between where some of the larger online plays fail to deliver trust and taste, and where the brick and mortar houses, the larger houses, are not focused at these lower price points. So really the sort of $5,000 to $100,000 lot range.
This is a huge part of the art market which isn't written about enough. We're always attracted to these telephone number price points for works at art fairs or at auction. Whereas I guess you're also representing artists or selling work by artists that maybe aren't talked about less, but it's cheaper work, it's an entry level stuff. It's presumably also cutting out the terror that actually people feel by raising their hand in an auction room or by walking into a kind of slightly terrifying white space of a gallery sometimes, right?
Absolutely. I mean, I think, you know, the ability to be able to educate oneself and peruse across numerous different sources of works and identify that work that you fall truly in love with, you know, from that first aesthetic onset, without the intimidation of walking into a gallery and having to know what to say and not look like a complete fool next to the academic stature of the gallerist or the auction expert, is certainly a huge advantage of our platform. But really, the key value is really on the seller side too, in that we've created a model that removes many of the cost and the time obstacles of the traditional selling. So if you have a $10,000 Damien Hirst print today, you go to the represented gallery, they're not really, you know, going to give you the interest in selling it at that price point. They just lose time and money on that. Similarly, you go to one of the bigger auction houses, on a unit economics basis, it doesn't justify their investment in a catalog, in an installation, to sell that lot. And so enter Padlate, and we can, in a matter of days, have that lot listed, have it filtered and validated by one of our specialists, up for sale with hundreds of thousands of collectors coming in and viewing the lots on a daily basis, and charging half of the commissions of the brick and mortar houses.
And as people will be able to hear in the background, there's advertising planes flying over the beach behind us. It's okay. The Miami sun is shining on our chat here, but we're obviously here in what is the sort of one of the most important weeks of the year for the bricks and mortar, the galleries. What's Padlate's place in a week like Art Basel Miami? Is it a good place to network? Is it a good place to talk about the brand and the service? Or is it just simply a good party, Alex?
Well, on day four, it's certainly a good place to drink. But for us, it's been, I think in the early days when we were building a brand, building reputation, it was important to come here and take part of the conversation and to be recognized and to look at how we could build a brand and build visibility. Today, I think we've been fortunate in building a lot of that through the work that we do with benefit auctions and through the many sort of high profile curator collaborations. And it's really for us, it's about coming down here and looking at ways that we can work with artists, with dealers. We consider the Art Basel, the convention center, galleries, a vital part of the overall art ecosystem.
And how do you know what people want? Because going to a collector's house, it's always interesting, whether you're a writer or whether you're an auctioneer. It's a fascinating thing to see the fact that if you're a collector, that goes from, yeah, the Rothko on the wall to the weird collection of original Stan Smith sneakers or something like that, right? Is that how you do your research? Is it the networking thing? Is it popping your head around the bedroom door when you go to house parties? How do you judge what people might want in an upcoming sale?
I mean, I think you've ultimately got to build a business for yourself, and you have to position yourself as the end collector. And many of my reasons for wanting to, with Aditya, my co-founder, to launch Padlate was really thinking about the hours that I spent sort of trawling through eBay looking for an albino peacock or Coors toys, whatever else. And then when I found that, I wasn't quite sure of the provenance and whether or not they'd been validated by someone. So I felt that we needed this sort of marketplace to validate all these types of things. And I am your classic sort of magpie brick and brack collector who collects enough numerous different categories. And I tend to live through a more pictorial form of educational absorption. And I think it's really just about, you know, going to as many exhibitions at people's homes and just staying current and seeing how people are collecting and thinking, what is it you yourself? At home with my wife, we have everything from, 300-year-old Turkish kilims to 17th century French busts to the latest contemporary artists from, the Red Hook movement in New York to 18th century portraits of sort of naval officers. And it's, a true variety and range. And I think this is, it's about learning how to be able to mix and match high and lowbrow items today, and how art plays an increasingly important part as this force of cultural validation.
That was Alexander Gilks of Padlate. Check them out online, a handsome place, albeit a virtual one, it is to do business too. All work and no play would make Miami Beach a far less vibrant boy. Art Basel Week is renowned for an energetic whirlwind of parties, whether it's cocktails in a bowling alley at the just-opened Edition Hotel, dancing poolside at the Deauville, or twerking with a martini in hand at the Raleigh. Pop's elite were out in full force, from the likes of Solange Knowles, Drake, and even Miley Cyrus, who was joined by the Flaming Lips. And with them came an endless supply of well-known mates. In need of a bit of musical relief after a long day of perusing the booths, producer Sir Holly headed over to the mainland for one of the more low-key events on this week's nighttime schedule. Brooklyn's TV on the radio have never been afraid of a bit of experimentation. Last week they headed Floridaward to play a couple of shows in Miami. In one of these events, done in collaboration with photography site Tumblr, they worked with artist Julian Gross, who designed the album art for their latest record, Seeds. But Gross didn't stop at the record sleeve and has created a small art exhibition inspired by the music, with fluorescent molten-like wall hangings and wells in the ground that look almost volcanic. In a small venue in Miami's Upper East Side called Miami Iron, Ironside, TV on the radio played alongside the exhibition, and Holly went along while the event was setting up to find out how you make art for music.
I am Julian Gross. I am the artist. That's how you say it, right?
Okay, that's the real pronunciation, right? That's how you say it in Art Basel.
And I am Tunde Adebinkbe, and I make the music, and I act, and I direct things, and also make some of the art. I can't hold a job, so I try to do a lot of things.
For TV on the Radio's new record, Seeds, I did all the artwork for the album artwork.
I think we had one 20-minute meeting and had some sketches going back and forth. But the entire time we were doing that, I was sort of like, at the end of this, I'm just going to tell you to go for it. Because oh, right. I know
house.
You're going to, yeah, at Dave's house. And we were doing all these sketches, and I was sort of like, I think it was, there's a technique on the album art where everything on the art animates by hand. There's a decoder screen that you move it across pages and lyrics and the cover and the back cover, and things spin and pretty much animate. And so we were discussing that technique and just kind of sketching out a few things. Basically, 15 minutes of the 20-minute conversation, I just realized that Julian was so far ahead of me in terms of what he was thinking about that I was like, I'll see you in 3 weeks whenever you have something, because I know I'm gonna love it, and I know, you know, I'm so happy to be doing this, you know, with one of my closest friends. And it's good. It's like, it's nice when you have a language between you and your friends that you don't really have to explain too much.
Rain comes down like it always does. This time I've got seeds on ground.
How do you turn an album art and cover art project into an entire exhibition? Because it's not like you're just showing what you did for the album here. It's a whole lot more.
Yeah, it's a whole different thing. Well, it's all the same thing. I mean, you know, whenever you want to make something, there needs to be an idea behind the same thing, not just an aesthetic, you know. I mean, you want it to look visually pleasing, of course, but there needs to be an idea of why you're doing that. And so this is just sort of an extension of that, and the things that I was thinking about when I think about Seeds, you know. Like the album cover, I turned it into an infinity mirror. So the seed that is actually the cover of the album references one of the lines in the song, you know, this time I got seeds on ground. So this one seed pod, when looking at it through the infinity mirror, turns into hundreds of pods laid down on the ground, and how you look around it, it just looks like an infinite amount of seeds. So it's really fun to play with those ideas of infinity, growing, dying, new life, death, you know, this sort of continual cycles of things.
There's a golden light that's right here. There's no bottom to this well. Wealth of love and wealth of ideas. Peace of mind beyond the sail.
It is all quite a sort of molten theme going on. It's all very brightly coloured, and there's things on the floor that look sort of volcanic. Can you maybe talk us through a few pieces and what the inspiration was?
Well, like this one here, it's a well, is sort of how I made it. And it is a direct reference from a song. There's a golden light that's right here. There's no bottom to this well. And I really like that song, and I like that part. And so, like, if you look in, you know, you'll see it goes down forever.
Like a yellow black hole.
Like a black hole. Or like a well with no bottom. This one was a direct sort of thing, you know, and I liked the ideas of infinity mirrors and sort of reflections with the idea of seeds and stuff. And so that one is sort of a direct reference. I mean, they really kind of all are. This one too, with the bones sort of coming out, these broken bones coming out of another sort of well. I mean, this one goes down and this one comes out, but it, you know, there's a lot of broken bones lyrics, and I like the idea of broken bones and the idea of sort of death and, you know, and life and stuff.
Tunde, what's it like seeing somebody else bring the music you've written to life visually? Because when you write a song, you know, I mean, you might have had all these pieces of artwork in your head and then some telepathic creativity occurred, but...
I mean, I can get to that in a second, but I think there's sort of a weird synesthesia, you know? Like, I was about to say, like, sometimes you can listen to music and close your eyes and you see images and, like, you have no idea where it's... You know, it's almost like it's not you, you know, where it's just this thing that pops up, you know, and it's like looking at something you're driving by in nature or something and just recognizing it, and then you try to bring it into the world somehow. And I feel like seeing all of this, you know, it made sense to me. It goes with the record and with the music very, very well. It's also, I don't even know if I told you this, but I had this dream, like, it's probably like 4 or 5 years ago. I had this the experience that I walked into my art studio and there was sort of like a little, you know, like we were like a crate, half crate filled with sticks and moss and mulch. On the other side of my studio, a conveyor belt. And on the conveyor belt, there were all these brightly colored fluorescent pods that were going one by one, like past. And I was just like, wow, that's really beautiful and fun and almost plastic. And it really, like, those things really did look like some of those. It's pretty crazy.
Yeah.
When you painted it like that, I was really, like, a part of me was just kind of like, why do I know that? And then I was like, oh, God, that's super weird.
Thanks, Holly. After the break, we're heading to NADA. That's not nothing. It's an actual thing. Another art fair, in fact. We're in Miami. Get someone over to refresh that cocktail. Pronto.
The brand new M24 iPhone app brings you the full radio offering from Monocle 24. Listen live to our 4 daily news programmes or catch the freshest tunes on our playlist. And of course, there's the Time Shift, where you can delve into our show archive and listen at your leisure. All our great magazine programmes, covering everything from international affairs to culture, design to urbanism, food and drink to entrepreneurship. It's all available anytime on the new, free Monocle 24 iPhone app. Monocle, keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
You're listening to Culture with me, Robert Bounds, on Monocle 24, coming to you from Florida for the 12th edition of Art Basel Miami Beach. We're going to nip to one of the smaller fairs now. NADA, or the New Art Dealers Alliance, is a not-for-profit organisation that's been giving galleries space to show their works in Miami since 2003 during Art Basel Week. It gives lesser established dealers the chance to get their faces known, but also, as we're about to find out, is the preferred fair for some gallerists. And New York Ed Stocker, has the story.
As you might be able to tell, things feel a little different here at the Deauville, which has hosted the New Art Dealers Alliance Fair, or NADA, since 2009. It's less frenzied than Art Basel. Walking into the large lobby instantly feels more spacious and cooler, and people are sharing lunch and watching a band play by the pool, which overlooks the rolling waves of North Beach. Here's NADA's director, Heather Hubb.
Essentially, I think what makes NADA special is that it's a fair and an organization started by dealers for dealers. So there's an understanding of what those needs are, and we come at it. That's how we approach everything that we do, but also the fairs. It's not a commercial venture for us. It's really about, you know, trying to make these guys happy and give them a platform where they're going to make money.
Getting into NADA is very competitive for galleries that are in their early stages. And when you have like a young or artist-run gallery, the first time you get into NADA is like your birthday or something. It's a really big deal, and that can sort of signal the beginning of your career as a dealer. This fair in particular for a young gallery is like a make it or break it place, where once you get in, it's like game on.
That's Adrienne Rubenstein, director of one of the galleries at NADA called Canada. She explains what keeps people coming back to show here after making that first big step.
Art Basel is, of course, for like the blue chip galleries and the top galleries. NADA is more of like a low-key, beachy, Lower East Side crowd. A lot of the galleries that do NADA probably could be at Basel or have done Basel, but sometimes they come back here because this fair since it costs less to do and less to be here, and it's kind of outside of the whole hype hub of South Beach, it's a lot less taxing, it's kind of more casual, and it can be better for business too because of those reasons.
And speaking of business, it seems things are done differently over here in the hotel. Gallerist Josh Lilly is exhibiting paintings by British artist Nick Goss, which combine acrylic, oil and silk screens with quite a neutral palette. It's the opening day here at the fair, so how have sales gone so far?
We sold all of the work in the first 2 hours of the fair. I call it the 10 till 1 slot. And that's pretty much how it is every year here. You've got to do the business then, because the fair really slows down afterwards. It's not a fair where people come back to, really. Whereas at the main fair, you know, people will come, go to the satellite fairs, and then, you know, return. That's your chance. Everybody's there. You know, the prices on the whole here are obviously less than at Art Basel. So, yeah, you perform for those 3 hours. And, I mean, the works, through the talking, you know, the works are of such good quality. But I knew what to expect, so very happy with it.
Josh tells me that it's not just the quick sales that draw him back, but also the people he gets to work with while he's here.
It's wonderful because there's a real shared camaraderie, I think, between the galleries. It's the intimacy of the booths, the kind of feeling like it's a bit of a kind of summer camp almost, you know, in everyone stays in the hotel where it's at, the pool's right there, the sea's right there. And, you know, I've in the past actually curated shows from just on the second, third day of, you know, for 6-9 months in advance by just bringing together a group of artists from other galleries. So you're really exposed to some really strong other programs and galleries and artwork. So, you know, it's a great thing to be involved in. But yeah, it really is, the focus is that first 3-4 hours, and then it kind of calms, but it's still a nice vibe throughout, I think.
It goes without saying that creativity has a strong foothold in any art fair, but it seems that this is one that nurtures its development rather than just displaying it. Maya Murphy is the program director of Recess Activities Inc. Based in New York's Soho, it's a studio and exhibition space that encourages audiences to see the process behind each piece of work. Here at NADA, they're showing work by John Misserandino, who has injected several pieces of marble with bright colours, giving depth to the different layers of the stone.
We invite between 5 to 6 artists a year to come into our space where they get 24-hour access. It's a storefront on Grand Street. They get 24-hour access, a material stipend, and between 1 to 2 months to create new work. And then we're open to the public 5 days a week so that people can come in and see a work in progress, meet the artist, see a work develop. And we're really interested in process-based work and sort of exposing the experimentation and trial and error that goes into art making. It feels really good to be a little separate from the main art fair. There's a certain, I think, freedom in doing something a little bit different when you're a little more off the beaten track, I think.
There's a lot of praise for NADA among the galleries here today, and Heather Hubb tells me that although some people turn down Art Basel in favour of it, many galleries have graduated on to the main fair.
There's a lot. There's quite a few, actually. Sometimes they come back and do it again because they just prefer being here. But they're not even in the special sections anymore. They're part of the main fair now that used to do NADA.
And Josh Lilly is one of the current dealers who, despite holding NADA in high regard, still has his eyes set on making it to Art Basel.
It depends on the project. Of course, there's more prestige in Art Basel, Miami Beach. And as the artworks go higher, if you want to try and bring in a different crowd or push the prices, you need to have that a different kind of context. So I'm not pretending I'd choose forever to be here, but I think, you know, it's certainly still happy having done it for 5-6 years.
While commercial interests mean Art Basel is the big prize, NADA has managed to maintain a laid-back atmosphere. It's more about casual clothes and cocktails here than the showy glitz of Miami's main act. With most of those involved with NADA staying at the Deauville, everyone makes sure that alongside the work, there's plenty of time for play. For Monocle at NADA, I'm Ed Stocker.
Thanks, Ed. And now to finish off the programme, let's hear from one last gallery. Not a least one, though. Stephen Friedman Gallery had such a beautiful booth with vintage furniture and rugs that I wish I could have bought the whole thing to live in, let alone just look at. Despite him showing new works from that wively provocateur Yinka Shonibari, natural and nostalgic abstracts by Andreas Eriksson, and a big green boulder by Tom Friedman that charmed more than menaced. Stephen Friedman talked us through it.
We plan art fairs far in advance, and every art fair is very particular. For Art Basel Miami, it's one of the most important fairs, and we design our stands so that people can circulate easily, and we try to come up with an idea that's also thematically driven. So, for example, this year we created an area that's devoted to two separate areas, one devoted to figuration and one devoted to landscape. And we've also created vignettes within those spaces where people can pause and look and sit and admire the work. So, for example, there's vintage furniture in both areas that allow people to really take their time and look at the work. And aesthetically, really, it draws people in. It's a way of imagining what the work ultimately will look like in a domestic environment, because we don't live in a white cube, and we all live with furniture and other objects around us, and it's important for people to get a good sense of what the work is going to look like in their homes.
I love the big green ball. It's the elephant in the room, maybe, on your booth here this year. Maybe you can tell us about that and whether it's persuaded anyone into buying it, hanging as it does like a sword of Damocles over your negotiation area, perhaps.
Yes, well, that's a really remarkable work by Tom Friedman. It's a gigantic green boulder, and hence the title of the work is Green Boulder. It's carved out of styrofoam. It's a very large and imposing, and we had always intended to hang it, suspend it, right over the center of the seating area in one of the two areas on the gallery, where it looks like at any moment it could fall and crash and injure people below it. But of course, the entire thing is made out of polystyrene, and it's in fact quite light, but no need to worry because it's very securely installed. And it's been quite wonderful. We are very close to selling that work. It will be sold during the fair. We're just in negotiations with it, and it's going to end up in a institutional collection.
Cool. And this is the interesting thing. We've talked to other gallerists about this today, that there are as many curators walking around as there are collectors.
Yes.
And it's kudos, presumably, for any gallery and the artist to be in a public gallery as much as a private collection, maybe more so.
Yes, I mean, that's extremely important. You know, there is, the spending power is obviously coming from the private sector. Some works of art are now too expensive for institutional collections. But because of the generosity of the trustees affiliated with these museums, they're able to prop up the acquisitions funds and support the acquisitions that the curators and museum directors want. Of course, it's very prestigious for an artist to be collected by an institution and for it to be shown and accessible to the public, because private collectors live in their own homes and their houses are not generally open to the public. And so, yes, an artist ultimately wants his work shown to as many people as possible.
That was Stephen Friedman bringing us to the end of this week's show from Art Basel Miami Beach. We hope you enjoyed it and can forgive the culture team. It's December tan. You've been listening to Culture with me, Robert Bound. My producer was Holly Fisher, who enjoyed the Miami scene so much she wore her bikini on the plane back to London. No wonder the guy next to her on the plane kept on pretending to fall asleep all over her. We're going to play you out with a song. I know, but the show's got my name on it. So deal, everybody, with Miami by Will Smith. Thank you for tuning in. Party in the sand where the heat is on, all night on the beach till the break of dawn.
Welcome to Miami, bienvenido a Miami.
Bouncing in the club where the heat is on, all night on the beach till the break of dawn.
I'm going to Miami.
Welcome to Miami.
Yo, I heard the rainstorms ain't nothing to mess with, but I can't feel a drip on the strip. It's a trip, ladies have dress full of your quip, and they be screaming out.
We loved your ass here.
So I'm thinking I'ma scoop me something hot.